and of our effects.
Lombard said, I'm damned if I'll give up my revolver. Wargrave said sharply, Mr. Lombard, you are a very strongly built and powerful young man, but ex-Inspector Blore is also a man of powerful physique. I do not know what the outcome of a struggle between you would be, but I can tell you this. On Blore's side, assisting him to the best of our ability will be myself, Dr. Armstrong, and Miss Claythorne. You will appreciate, therefore, that the odds against you, if you choose to resist, will be somewhat heavy. Lombard threw his head back. His teeth showed in what was almost a snarl. Oh, very well, then, since you've got it all taped out. Mr. Justice Wargrave nodded his head.
You are a sensible young man. Where is this revolver of yours?
In the drawer of the table by my bed.
Good.
I'll fetch it.
I think it would be desirable if we went with you.
Philip said with a smile that was still nearer a snarl. Suspicious devil, aren't you? They went along the corridor to Lombard's room. Philip strode across the bed table and jerked open the drawer. Then he recoiled with an oath. The drawer of the bed table was empty.
Satisfied?
Asked Lombard. He had stripped of the skin, and he and his room had been meticulously searched by the other three men. Vera Claythorne was outside in the corridor. The search proceeded methodically. In turn, Armstrong, the judge, and Blore submitted to the same test. The four men emerged from Blore's room and approached Vera. It was the judge who spoke.
I hope you will understand, Miss Claythorne, that we can make no exceptions. That revolver must be found. You have, I presume, a bathing dress with you?
Vera nodded.
Then I will ask you to go into your room and put it on, and then come out to us here.
Vera went into her room and shut the door. She reappeared in under a minute, dressed in a tight-fitting silk-rucked bathing dress. Wargrave nodded approval.
Thank you, Miss Claythorne. Now, if you will remain here, we will search your room.
Vera waited patiently in the corridor until they emerged. Then she went in, dressed, and came out to where they were waiting. The judge said,
We are now assured of one thing. There are no lethal weapons or drugs in the possession of any of us five. That is one point to the good. We will now place the drugs in a safe place. There is, I think, a silver chest, is there not, in the pantry.
Blore said, That's all very well, but who's to have the key? You, I suppose. Mr. Justice Wargrave made no reply. He went down to the pantry and the others followed him. There was a small case there designed for the purpose of holding silver and plate. By the judge's directions, the various drugs were placed in this and it was locked. Then, still on Wargrave's instructions, the chest was lifted into the plate cupboard and this in turn was locked. The judge then gave the key of the chest to Philip Lombard and the key of the cupboard to Blore. He said,
You two are the strongest physically. It would be difficult for either of you to get the key from the other. It would be impossible for any of us three to do so. To break open the cupboard or the plate chest would be a noisy and cumbersome proceeding, and one which could hardly be carried out without attention being attracted to what was going on.
He paused, then went on.
We are still faced by one very grave problem. What has become of Mr. Lombard's revolver?
Blore said, Seems to me its owner is the most likely person to know that. A white dint showed in Philip Lombard's nostrils. He said,
You damn pig-headed fool, I tell you it's been stolen from me.
Wargrave asked,
When did you see it last?
Last night.
It was in the drawer when I went to bed, ready in case anything happened. The judge nodded. He said,
It must have been taken this morning during the confusion of searching for Rogers, or after his dead body was discovered.
Vera said,
It must be hidden somewhere about the house. We must look for it.
Mr. Justice Wargrave's finger was stroking his chin. He said,
I doubt if our search will result in anything. Our murderer has had plenty of time to devise a hiding place. I do not fancy we shall find that revolver easily.
Blore said forcefully, I don't know where the revolver is, but I'll bet I know where something is. That hypodermic syringe. Follow me. He opened the front door and led the way around the house. A little distance away from the dining room window, he found the syringe. Beside it was a smashed china figure, a sixth broken soldier boy. Blore said in a satisfied voice, Only place it could be. After he'd killed her, he opened the window and threw out the syringe and picked up the china figure from the table and followed on with that. There were no prints on the syringe. It had been carefully wiped. Vera said in a determined voice,
Now let us look for the revolver.
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
By all means. But in doing so, let us be careful to keep together. Remember, if we separate, the murderer gets his chance.
They searched the house carefully from attic to cellars, but without result. The revolver was still missing. Chapter 13 One of us. One of us. One of us. Three words endlessly repeated, dinning themselves hour after hour into receptive brains. Five people, five frightened people. Five people who watched each other, who now hardly troubled to hide their state of nervous tension. There was little pretense now, no formal veneer of conversation. They were five enemies linked together by a mutual instinct of self-preservation. And all of them suddenly looked less like human beings. They were reverting to more bestial types. Like a wary old tortoise, Mr. Justice Wargrave sat hunched up, his body motionless, his eyes keen and alert. Ex-Inspector Blore looked coarser and clumsier in build. His walk was that of a slow, padding animal. His eyes were bloodshot. There was a look of mingled ferocity and stupidity about him. He was like a beast at bay, ready to charge its pursuers. Philip Lombard's senses seemed heightened rather than diminished. His ears reacted to the slightest sound. His step was lighter and quicker. His body was lithe and graceful. And he smiled often, his lips curling back from his long, white teeth. Vera Claythorne was very quiet. She sat most of the time huddled in a chair. Her eyes stared ahead of her into space. She looked dazed. She was like a bird that has dashed its head against glass and that has been picked up by a human hand. It crouches there, terrified, unable to move, hoping to save itself by its immobility. Armstrong was in a pitiable condition of nerves. He twitched and his hands shook. He lighted cigarette after cigarette and stubbed them out almost immediately. The forced inaction of their position seemed to gall him more than the others. Every now and then he broke out into a torrent of nervous speech.
We shouldn't just be sitting here doing nothing. There must be something. Surely there is something that we can do if we lit a bonfire.
Blore said heavily, In this weather. The rain was pouring down again. The wind came in fitful gusts. The depressing sound of the pattering rain nearly drove them mad. By tacit consent, they had adopted a plan of campaign. They all sat in the big drawing room. Only one person left the room at a time. The other four waited till the fifth returned. Lombard said,
It's only a question of time. The weather will clear. Then we can do something, signal, light fires, make a raft, something.
Armstrong said with a sudden cackle of laughter,
A question of time. time. We can't afford time. We shall all be dead.
Mr. Justice Wargrave said, and his small, clear voice was heavy with passionate determination.
Not if we are careful. We must be very careful.
The midday meal had been duly eaten, but there had been no conventional formality about it. All five of them had gone to the kitchen. In the larder they had found a great store of tinned foods. They had opened a tin of tongue and two tins of fruit. They had eaten standing round the kitchen table. Then, herding close together, they had returned to the drawing-room to sit there, sit, watching each other. And by now the thoughts that ran through their brains were abnormal, feverish, diseased. "It's Armstrong. I saw him looking at me sideways just then. His eyes are mad. Quite mad. Perhaps he isn't a doctor at all. That's it, of course. He's a lunatic. Escaped from some doctor's house, pretending to be a doctor. It's true. Shall I tell them? Shall I scream out? No, it won't do to put him on his guard. Besides, he can seem so sane. What time is it? Only 3:15. Oh, God, I shall go mad myself. Yes, it's Armstrong. He's watching me now. It won't get me. I can take care of myself. I've been in tight places before. Where the hell is that revolver? Who took it? Who's got it? Nobody's got it, we know that. We were all searched. Nobody can have it, but someone knows where it is.
They're going mad. They're all going mad. Afraid of death. We're all afraid of death. I'm afraid of death, yes, but that doesn't stop death coming. The hearse is at the door, sir. Where did I read that? The girl. I'll watch the girl. Yes, I'll watch the girl.
3:40. Only 3:40. Perhaps the clock has stopped. I don't understand. No, I don't understand. This sort of thing can't happen. It is happening. Why don't we wake up? Wake up. Judgment Day. No, not that. If only I could think my head. Something's happening in my head. It's going to burst. It's going to split. This sort of thing can't happen. What's the time? Oh, God, it's only 3:45. I must keep my head. I must keep my head. If only I keep my head, it's all perfectly clear, all worked out. But nobody must suspect. It may do the trick. It must. Which one? That's the question. Which one? I think. Yes, I rather think. Yes. Him.
When the clock struck 5, they all jumped. Vera said, "Does anyone want tea?"
There was a moment's silence.
Blore said, "I'd like a cup."
Vera rose. She said,
"I'll go and make it. You can all stay here."
Mr. Justice Wargrave said gently,
"I think, my dear young lady, we would all prefer to come and watch you make it."
Vera stared, then gave a short, rather hysterical laugh. She said,
"Of course you would."
5 people went into the kitchen. Tea was made and drunk by Vera and Blore. The other 3 had whiskey, opening a fresh bottle and using a siphon from a nailed-up case. The judge murmured with a reptilian smile,
"We must be very careful."
They went back again to the drawing-room. Although it was summer, the room was dark. Lombard switched on the lights, but they did not come on. He said,
"Of course. The engine's not been run today since Rogers hasn't been there to see to it."
He hesitated and said,
"We could go out and get it going, I suppose."
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
"There are packets of candles in the larder. I saw them. Better use those."
Lombard went out. The other 4 sat watching each other. He came back with a box of candles and a pile of saucers. 5 candles were lit and placed about the room. The time was 6:15. At 6:20, Vera felt that to sit there longer was unbearable. She would go to her room and bathe her aching head and temples in cold water. She got up and went towards the door. Then she remembered and came back and got a candle out of the box. She lighted it, let a little wax pour into a saucer and stuck the candle firmly to it. Then she went out of the room, shutting the door behind her and leaving the 4 men inside. She went up the stairs and along the passage to her room. As she opened her door, she suddenly halted and stood stock still. Her nostrils quivered. The sea. The smell of the sea at St. Tridenic. That was it. She could not be mistaken. Of course one smelt the sea on an island anyway, but this was different. It was the smell there had been on the beach that day, with the tide out and the rocks covered with seaweed drying in the sun. "Can I swim out to the island, Miss Claythorne? Why can't I swim out to the island?" Horrid, whiny, spoilt little brat. If it weren't for him, Hugo would be rich, able to marry the girl he loved. Hugo. Surely. Surely Hugo was beside her. No, waiting for her in the room. She made a step forward. The draught from the window caught the flame of the candle. It flickered and went out. In the dark, she was suddenly afraid. "Don't be a fool," Vera Claythorne urged herself. "It's all right. The others are downstairs, all four of them. There's no one in the room. There can't be. You're imagining things, my girl." But that smell of the beach at St. Tridenic, that wasn't imagined. It was true. And there was someone in the room. She had heard something. Surely she had heard something. And then, as she stood there listening, a cold, clammy hand touched her throat, a wet hand smelling of the sea. Vera screamed. She screamed and screamed, screams of the utmost terror, wild, desperate cries for help. She did not hear the sounds from below, of a chair being overturned, of a door opening, of men's feet running up the stairs. She was conscious only of supreme terror. Then, restoring her sanity, lights flickered in the doorway, candles, men hurrying into the room. "What the devil? What's happened? Good God, what is it?" She shuddered, took a step forward, collapsed on the floor. She was only half aware of someone bending over her, of someone forcing her head down between her knees. Then, at a sudden exclamation, a quick, "My God, look at that!" her senses returned. She opened her eyes and raised her head. She saw what it was the men with the candles were looking at. A broad ribbon of wet seaweed was hanging down from the ceiling. It was that which in the darkness had swayed against her throat. It was that which she had taken for a clammy hand, a drowned hand come back from the dead to squeeze the life out of her. She began to laugh hysterically. She said, "It was seaweed. Only seaweed. And that's what the smell was." And then the faintness came over her once more, waves upon waves of sickness. Again someone took her head and forced it between her knees. Eons of time seemed to pass. They were offering her something to drink, pressing the glass against her lips. She smelt brandy. She was just about to gulp the spirit gratefully down when suddenly a warning note, like an alarm bell, sounded in her brain. She sat up, pushing the glass away. She said sharply, "Where did this come from?" Blore's voice answered. He stared a minute before speaking. He said, "I got it from downstairs." Vera cried, "I won't drink it!" There was a moment's silence. Then Lombard laughed. He said with appreciation, "Good for you, Vera. You've got your wits about you, even if you have been scared half out of your life. I'll get a fresh bottle that hasn't been opened." He went swiftly out. Vera said uncertainly, "I'm all right now. I'll have some water." Armstrong supported her as she struggled to her feet. She went over to the basin, swaying and clutching at him for support. She let the cold tap run and then filled the glass. Blore said resentfully, "That brandy's all right." Armstrong said, "How do you know?" Blore said angrily, "I didn't put anything in it. That's what you're getting at, I suppose." Armstrong said, "I'm not saying you did. You might have done, or someone might have tampered with a bottle for just this emergency." Lombard came swiftly back into the room. He had a new bottle of brandy in his hands and a corkscrew. He thrust the sealed bottle under Vera's nose. "There you are, my girl. Absolutely no deception." He peeled off the tin foil and drew the cork. "Lucky there's a good supply of spirits in the house. Thoughtful of UN Owen." Vera shuddered violently. Armstrong held the glass while Philip poured the brandy into it. He said, "You'd better drink this, Miss Claythorne. You've had a nasty shock." Vera drank a little of the spirit. The colour came back to her face. Philip Lombard said with a laugh, "Well, here's one murder that hasn't gone according to plan." Vera said almost in a whisper,
"You think
that was what was meant?" Lombard nodded.
"Expected you to pass out through fright. Some people would have, wouldn't they, Doctor?"
Armstrong did not commit himself. He said doubtfully,
"Impossible to say. Young, healthy subject, no cardiac weakness, unlikely. On the other hand..."
He picked up the glass of brandy that Blore had brought. He dipped a finger in it, tasted it gingerly. His expression did not alter. He said dubiously,
"Tastes all right."
Blore stepped forward angrily. He said,
"If you're saying that I tampered with that, I'll knock your ruddy block off."
Vera, her wits revived by the brandy, made a diversion by saying,
"Where's the judge?"
The three men looked at each other.
"That's odd. Thought he came up with us."
Blore said, "So did I."
"What about it, Doctor? You came up the stairs behind me."
Armstrong said, "I thought he was following me. Of course he'd be bound to go slower than we did. He's an old man."
They looked at each other again. Lombard said, "It's damned odd." Blore cried, "We must look for him." He started for the door. The others followed him, Vera last. As they went down the stairs, Armstrong said over his shoulder,
"Of course he may have stayed in the living room."
They crossed the hall.
Armstrong called out loudly, "Wargrave? Wargrave, where are you?"
There was no answer. A deadly silence filled the house, apart from the gentle patter of the rain. Then, in the entrance to the drawing-room door, Armstrong stopped dead. The others crowded up and looked over his shoulder. Somebody cried out. Mr. Justice Wargrave was sitting in his high-backed chair at the end of the room. Two candles burnt on either side of him. But what shocked and startled the onlookers was the fact that he sat there robed in scarlet, with a judge's wig upon his head. Dr. Armstrong motioned to the others to keep back. He himself walked across to the silent, staring figure, reeling a little as he walked like a drunken man. He bent forward, peering into the still face. Then, with a swift movement, he raised the wig. It fell to the floor, revealing the high, bald forehead with, in the very middle, a round, stained mark from which something had trickled. Dr. Armstrong lifted the lifeless hand and felt for the pulse. Then he turned to the others. He said, and his voice was expressionless, dead, far away, "He's been shot." Blore said,
"God, the revolver!"
The doctor said, still in the same lifeless voice, "Got him through the head. Instantaneous." Vera stooped to the wig. She said, and her voice shook with horror,
"Miss Brent's missing grey wool."
Blore said,
"And the scarlet curtain that was missing from the bathroom."
Vera whispered,
"So this is what they wanted them for."
Suddenly, Philip Lombard laughed, a high, unnatural laugh.
"Five little soldier boys going in for law. One got in Chancery, and then there were four. That's the end of Mr. Bloody Justice Wargrave. No more pronouncing sentence for him. No more putting on of the black cap. Here's the last time he'll ever sit in court. No more summing up and sending innocent men to death. How Edward Seaton would laugh if he were here. God, how he'd laugh!"
His outburst shocked and startled the others. Vera cried,
"Only this morning you said he was the one."
Philip Lombard's face changed, sobered. He said in a low voice,
"I know I did. Well, I was wrong. Here's one more of us who's been proved innocent. Too late."
Chapter 14. They had carried Mr. Justice Wargrave up to his room and laid him on the bed. Then they had come down again and had stood in the hall, looking at each other. Blore said heavily,
"What do we do now?"
Lombard said briskly.
Have something to eat. We've got to eat, you know.
Once again they went into the kitchen. Again they opened a tin of tongue. They ate mechanically, almost without tasting. Vera said, I shall never eat tongue again. They finished the meal. They sat round the kitchen table staring at each other. Blore said, Only four of us now. Who'll be the next? Armstrong stared. He said, almost mechanically, We must be very careful. And stopped. Blore nodded.
That's what he said. And now he's dead.
Armstrong said, How did it happen, I wonder? Lombard swore. He said,
Damned clever double-cross. That stuff was planted in Miss Claythorne's room, and it worked just as it was intended to. Everyone dashes up there, thinking she's being murdered, and so, in the confusion, someone caught the old boy off his guard.
Blore said, Why didn't anyone hear the shot? Lombard shook his head.
Miss Claythorne was screaming, the wind was howling, we were running about and calling out. No, it wouldn't be heard.
He paused.
But that trick's not going to work again. You'll have to try something else next.
Blore said, He probably will. There was an unpleasant tone in his voice. The two men eyed each other. Armstrong said, Four of us, and we don't know which.
Blore said, I know.
Vera said, I haven't the least doubt.
Armstrong said slowly,
I suppose I do know, really.
Philip Lombard said,
I think I've got a pretty good idea now.
Again they all looked at each other. Vera staggered to her feet. She said,
I feel awful. I must go to bed. I'm dead beat.
Lombard said,
Might as well. No good sitting watching each other.
Blore said, I've no objection. The doctor murmured, The best thing to do, although I doubt if any of us will sleep. They moved to the door. Blore said,
I wonder where that revolver is now.
They went up the stairs. The next move was a little like a scene in a farce. Each one of the four stood with a hand on his or her bedroom door handle. Then, as though at a signal, each one stepped into the room and pulled the door shut. There were sounds of bolts and locks, of the moving of furniture. Four frightened people were barricaded in until morning. Philip Lombard drew a breath of relief as he turned from adjusting a chair under the door handle. He strolled across to the dressing table. By the light of the flickering candle, he studied his face curiously. He said softly to himself, Yes, this business has got you rattled, all right. His sudden wolf-like smile flashed out. He undressed quickly. He went over to the bed, placing his wristwatch on the table by the bed. Then he opened the drawer of the table. He stood there, staring down at the revolver that was inside it. Vera Claythorne lay in bed. The candle still burned beside her, and yet she could not summon the courage to put it out. She was afraid of the dark. She told herself again and again, You're all right until morning. Nothing happened last night. Nothing will happen tonight. Nothing can happen. You're locked and bolted in. No one can come near you. And she thought suddenly, Of course. I can stay here. Stay here, locked in. Food doesn't really matter. I can stay here, safely, till help comes. Even if it's a day or 2 days. Stay here. Yes, but could she stay here, hour after hour, with no one to speak to, with nothing to do but think? She'd begin to think of Cornwall, of Hugo, of what she'd said to Cyril. Horrid, whiny little boy, always pestering her.
Miss Claythorne, why can't I swim out to the rock? I can, I know I can.
Was it her voice that had answered,
Of course you can, Cyril, really. I know that. Can I go then, Miss Claythorne? Well, you see, Cyril, your mother gets so nervous about you. I'll tell you what, tomorrow you can swim out to the rock. I'll talk to your mother on the beach and distract her attention, and then when she looks for you, there you'll be, standing on the rock, waving to her. It will be a surprise. Oh, good egg, Miss Claythorne, that'll be a lark.
She'd said it now. Tomorrow. Hugo was going to Newquay. When he came back, it would be all over. Yes, but supposing it wasn't. Supposing it went wrong. Cyril might be rescued in time. And then he'd say, Miss Claythorne said I could. Well, what of it? One must take some risk. If the worst happened, she'd brazen it out.
How can you tell such a wicked lie, Cyril? Of course I never said any such thing.
They'd believe her all right. Cyril often told stories. He was an untruthful child. Cyril would know, of course, but that didn't matter. And anyway, nothing would go wrong. She'd pretend to swim out after him, but she'd arrive too late. Nobody would ever suspect. Had Hugo suspected? Was that why he had looked at her in that queer, far-off way? Had Hugo known? Was that why he had gone off after the inquest so hurriedly? He hadn't answered the one letter she had written to him. Hugo. Vera turned restlessly in bed. No, she mustn't think of Hugo. It hurt too much. That was all over, over and done with. Hugo must be forgotten. Why this evening had she suddenly felt that Hugo was in the room with her? She stared up at the ceiling, stared at the big black hook in the middle of the room. She'd never noticed that hook before. The seaweed had hung from that. She shivered as she remembered that cold, clammy touch on her neck. She didn't like that hook on the ceiling. It drew your eyes, fascinated you. A big black hook. Ex-Inspector Blore sat on the side of his bed. His small eyes, red-rimmed and bloodshot, were alert in the solid mass of his face. He was like a wild boar waiting to charge. He felt no inclination to sleep. The menace was coming very near now. 6 out of 10. For all his sagacity, for all his caution and astuteness, the old judge had gone the way of the rest. Blore snorted with a kind of savage satisfaction. What was it the old geezer had said? We must be very careful. Self-righteous, smuggled hypocrite. Sitting up in court, feeling like God Almighty, he'd got his all right. No more being careful for him. And now there were 4 of them. The girl, Lombard, Armstrong, and himself. Very soon another of them would go. But it wouldn't be William Henry Blore. He'd see to that all right. But the revolver. What about the revolver? That was a disturbing factor. The revolver. Blore sat on his bed, his brow furrowed, his little eyes creased and puckered while he pondered the problem of the revolver. In the silence he could hear the clocks strike downstairs. Midnight. He relaxed a little now. Even went so far as to lie down on his bed, but he did not undress. He lay there thinking. Going over the whole business from the beginning, methodically, painstakingly, as he had been wont to do in his police officer days. It was thoroughness that paid in the end. The candle was burning down. Looking to see if the matches were within easy reach of his hand, he blew it out. Strangely enough, he found the darkness disquieting. It was as though 1,000 age-old fears woke and struggled for supremacy in his brain. Faces floated in the air. The judge's face crowned with that mockery of grey wool. The cold, dead face of Mrs. Rogers. The convulsed purple face of Anthony Marston. Another face. Pale, spectacled, with a small straw-coloured moustache. A face that he had seen sometime or other, but when? Not on the island. No, much longer ago than that. Funny that he couldn't put a name to it. Silly sort of face, really. Fellow looked a bit of a mug. Of course. It came to him with a real shock. Lander. Odd to think he'd completely forgotten what Lander looked like. Only yesterday he'd been trying to recall the fellow's face and hadn't been able to. And now here it was. Every feature clear and distinct, as though he had seen it only yesterday. Lander had had a wife. A thin slip of a woman with a worried face. There'd been a kid too, a girl about 14. For the first time he wondered what had become of them. The revolver. What had become of the revolver? That was much more important. The more he thought about it, the more puzzled he was. He didn't understand this revolver business. Somebody in the house had got that revolver. Downstairs a clock struck one. Bloor's thoughts were cut short. He sat up on the bed, suddenly alert. For he had heard a sound, a very faint sound, somewhere outside his bedroom door. There was someone moving about in the darkened house. The perspiration broke out on his forehead. Who was it, moving secretly and silently along the corridors? Someone who was up to no good, he'd bet that. Noiselessly, in spite of his heavy build, he dropped off the bed and with two strides was standing by the door listening. But the sound did not come again. Nevertheless, Bloor was convinced that he was not mistaken. He had heard a footfall just outside his door. The hair rose slightly on his scalp. He knew fear again. Someone creeping about stealthily in the night. He listened, but the sound was not repeated. And now a new temptation assailed him. He wanted desperately to go out and investigate. If he could only see who it was prowling about in the darkness. But to open his door would be the action of a fool. Very likely that was exactly what the other was waiting for. He might even have meant Bloor to hear what he had heard, counting on him coming out to investigate. Bloor stood rigid, listening. He could hear sounds everywhere now, cracks, rustles, mysterious whispers. But his dogged, realistic brain knew them for what they were, the creations of his own heated imagination. And then suddenly he heard something that was not imagination. Footsteps, very soft, very cautious, but plainly audible to a man listening with all his ears as Bloor was listening. They came softly along the corridor. Both Lombard's and Armstrong's rooms were further from the stairhead than his. They passed his door without hesitating or faltering. And as they did so, Bloor made up his mind. He meant to see who it was. The footsteps had definitely passed his door going to the stairs. Where was the man going? When Bloor acted, he acted quickly, surprisingly so for a man who looked so heavy and slow. He tiptoed back to the bed, slipped matches into his pocket, detached the plug of the electric lamp by his bed and picked it up, winding the flex round it. It was a chromium affair with a heavy ebonite base, a useful weapon. He sprinted noiselessly across the room, removed the chair from under the door handle, and with precaution unlocked and unbolted the door. He stepped out into the corridor. There was a faint sound in the hall below. Bloor ran noiselessly in his stockinged feet to the head of the stairs. At that moment he realized why it was he had heard all these sounds so clearly. The wind had died down completely and the sky must have cleared. There was faint moonlight coming in through the landing window, and it illuminated the hall below. Bloor had an instantaneous glimpse of a figure just passing out through the front door. In the act of running down the stairs in pursuit, he paused. Once again, he had nearly made a fool of himself. This was a trap, perhaps, to lure him out of the house. But what the other man didn't realize was that he had made a mistake, had delivered himself neatly into Bloor's hands. For of the three tenanted rooms upstairs, one must now be empty. All that had to be done was to ascertain which. Bloor went swiftly back along the corridor. He paused first at Dr. Armstrong's door and tapped. There was no answer. He waited a minute, then went on to Philip Lombard's room. Here the answer came at once. Who's there? It's Bloor. I don't think Armstrong is in his room. Wait a minute. He went on to the door at the end of the corridor. Here he tapped again. Miss Claythorne? Miss Claythorne! Vera's voice, startled, answered him. Who is it? What's the matter? It's all right, Miss Claythorne. Wait a minute. I'll come back. He raced back to Lombard's room. The door opened as he did so. Lombard stood there. He held a candle in his left hand. He had pulled on his trousers over his pajamas. His right hand rested in the pocket of his pajama jacket. He said sharply, "What the hell's all this?" Bloor explained rapidly. Lombard's eyes lit up. "Armstrong, eh? So he's our pigeon." He moved along to Armstrong's door. "Sorry, Bloor, but I don't take anything on trust." He rapped sharply on the panel. "Armstrong? Armstrong!" There was no answer. Lombard dropped to his knees and peered through the keyhole. He inserted his little finger gingerly into the lock. He said, "Key's not in the door on the inside." Bloor said, "That means he locked it on the outside and took it with him." Philip nodded.
ordinary precaution to take. We'll get him, Blaw. This time we'll get him. Half a second.
He raced along to Vera's room.
Vera?
Yes?
We're hunting Armstrong. He's out of his room. Whatever you do, don't open your door. Understand?
Yes, I understand.
If Armstrong comes along and says that I've been killed or Blaw's been killed, pay no attention, see? Only open your door if both Blaw and I speak to you. Got that?
Vera said,
Yes, I'm not a complete fool.
Lombard said, Good. He joined Blaw. He said,
And now, after him. The hunt's up.
Blaw said, We'd better be careful. He's got a revolver, remember? Philip Lombard, racing down the stairs, chuckled. He said,
That's where you're wrong.
He undid the front door, remarking, Latch pushed back so he could get in again easily. He went on,
I've got that revolver.
He took it half out of his pocket as he spoke. Found it put back in my drawer tonight. Blaw stopped dead on the doorstep. His face changed. Philip Lombard saw it.
Don't be a damned fool, Blaw. I'm not going to shoot you. Go back and barricade yourself in, if you like. I'm off after Armstrong.
He started off into the moonlight. Blaw, after a minute's hesitation, followed him. He thought to himself,
I suppose I'm asking for it, after all.
After all, he had tackled criminals armed with revolvers before now. Whatever else he lacked, Blaw did not lack courage. Show him the danger and he would tackle it pluckily. He was not afraid of danger in the open, only of danger undefined and tinged with the supernatural. Vera, left to await results, got up and dressed. She glanced over once or twice at the door. It was a good, solid door. It was both bolted and locked and had an oak chair wedged under the handle. It could not be broken open by force. Certainly not by Dr. Armstrong. He was not a physically powerful man. If she were Armstrong intent on murder, it was cunning that she would employ, not force. She amused herself by reflecting on the means he might employ. He might, as Philip had suggested, announce that one of the other two men was dead. Or he might possibly pretend to be mortally wounded himself, might drag himself groaning to her door. There were other possibilities. He might inform her that the house was on fire. More, he might actually set the house on fire. Yes, that would be a possibility. Lure the other two men out of the house, then, having previously laid a trail of petrol, he might set light to it, and she, like an idiot, would remain barricaded in her room until it was too late. She crossed over to the window. Not too bad. At a pinch, one could escape that way. It would mean a drop, but there was a handy flower bed. She sat down, and picking up her diary, began to write in it, in a clear, flowing hand. One must pass the time. Suddenly, she stiffened to attention. She had heard a sound. It was, she thought, a sound like breaking glass, and it came from somewhere downstairs. She listened hard, but the sound was not repeated. She heard, or thought she heard, stealthy sounds of footsteps. The creak of stairs, the rustle of garments. But there was nothing definite, and she concluded, as Blaw had done earlier, that such sounds had their origin in her own imagination. But presently she heard sounds of a more concrete nature. People moving about downstairs. The murmur of voices. Then the very decided sound of someone mounting the stairs. Doors opening and shutting, feet going up to the attics overhead. More noises from there. Finally, the steps came along the passage. Lombard's voice said,
Vera, you all right?
Yes. What happened?
Blaw's voice said, Will you let us in?
Vera went to the door. She removed the chair, unlocked the door, and slid back the bolt. She opened the door. The two men were breathing hard. Their feet and the bottom of their trousers were soaking wet. She said again,
What's happened?
Lombard said, Armstrong's disappeared.
Vera cried, What?
Lombard said, Vanished, clean off the island.
Blaw concurred,
Vanished, that's the word, like some damned conjuring trick.
Vera said impatiently,
Nonsense, he's hiding somewhere.
Blaw said,
No, he isn't. I tell you, there's nowhere to hide on this island. It's as bare as your hand. There's moonlight outside, as clear as day it is, and he's not to be found.
Vera said,
He stumbled back to the house.
Blaw said, We thought of that. We've searched the house too. You must have heard us. He's not here, I tell you. He's gone. Clean vanished. Vamoosed.
Vera said incredulously,
I don't believe it.
Lombard said, It's true, my dear.
He paused and then said,
There's one other little fact. A pane in the dining room window has been smashed.
and there are only three little soldier boys on the table. Chapter 15. Three people sat eating breakfast in the kitchen. Outside, the sun shone. It was a lovely day. The storm was a thing of the past. And with the change in the weather, a change had come in the mood of the prisoners on the island. They felt now like people just awakening from a nightmare. There was danger, yes, but it was danger in daylight. That paralyzing atmosphere of fear that had wrapped round them like a blanket yesterday while the wind howled outside was gone. Lombard said, "We'll try heliographing today with a mirror from the highest point of the island. Some bright lad wandering on the cliff will recognize SOS when he sees it, I hope. In the evening we could try a bonfire, only there isn't much wood. And anyway, they might just think it was song and dance and merriment." Vera said, "Surely someone can read Morse? And then they'll come to take us off long before this evening." Lombard said, "The weather's cleared all right, but the sea hasn't gone down yet. Terrific swell on. They won't be able to get a boat near the island before tomorrow." Vera cried, "Another night in this place." Lombard shrugged his shoulders. "May as well face it. 24 hours will do it, I think. If we can last out that, we'll be all right." Bloor cleared his throat. He said, "We'd better come to a clear understanding. What's happened to Armstrong?" Lombard said, "Well, we've got one piece of evidence. Only three little soldier boys left on the dinner table. It looks as though Armstrong had got his quietus." Vera said, "Then why haven't you found his dead body?" Bloor said, "Exactly." Lombard shook his head. He said, "It's damned odd. No getting over it." Bloor said doubtfully, "It might have been thrown into the sea." Lombard said sharply, "By whom? You? Me? You saw him go out the front door. You come along and find me in my room. We go out and search together. When the devil had I time to kill him and carry his body round the island?" Bloor said, "I don't know, but I do know one thing." Lombard said, "What's that?" Bloor said, "The revolver. It was your revolver. It's in your possession now. There's nothing to show that it hasn't been in your possession all along." "Come now, Bloor, we were all searched." "Yes, you'd hidden it away before that happened. Afterwards, you just took it back again." "My good blockhead, I swear to you that it was put back in my drawer. Greatest surprise I ever had in my life when I found it there." Bloor said, "You ask us to believe a thing like that. Why the devil should Armstrong, or anyone else for that matter, put it back?" Lombard raised his shoulders hopelessly. "I haven't the least idea. It's just crazy. The last thing one would expect. There seems no point in it." Bloor agreed. "No, there isn't. You might have thought of a better story. Rather proof that I'm telling the truth, isn't it?" "I don't look at it that way." Philip said, "You wouldn't." Bloor said, "Look here, Mr. Lombard, if you're an honest man, as you pretend." Philip murmured, "When did I lay claims to being an honest man? No, indeed, I never said that." Bloor went on stolidly, "If you're speaking the truth, there's only one thing to be done. As long as you have that revolver, Miss Claythorne and I are at your mercy. The only fair thing is to put that revolver with the other things that are locked up, and you and I will hold the two keys still." Philip Lombard lit a cigarette. As he puffed smoke, he said, "Don't be an ass. You won't agree to that?" "No, I won't. That revolver's mine. I need it to defend myself, and I'm going to keep it." Bloor said, "In that case, we're bound to come to one conclusion." "That I'm UN Owen? Think what you damn well please, but I'll ask you, if that's so, why didn't I pot you with the revolver last night? I could have, about 20 times over. Bloor shook his head. He said, "I don't know, and that's a fact." He must have had some reason. Vera had taken no part in the discussion. She stirred now and said, "I think you're both behaving like a pair of idiots." Lombard looked at her. "What's this?" Vera said, "You've forgotten the nursery rhyme. Don't you see there's a clue there?" She recited in a meaning voice, "Four little soldier boys going out to sea, a red herring swallowed one, and then there were three." She went on, "A red herring. That's the vital clue. Armstrong's not dead.
He took away the China soldier to make you think he was. You may say what you like, Armstrong's on the island still. His disappearance is just a red herring across the track.
Lombard sat down again. He said, "You know, you may be right." Bloor said, "Yes, but if so, where is he? We've searched the place outside and inside." Vera said scornfully, "We all searched for the revolver, didn't we, and couldn't find it, but it was somewhere all the time." Lombard murmured, "There's a slight difference in size, my dear, between a man and a revolver." Vera said, "I don't care. I'm sure I'm right." Bloor murmured, rather giving himself away, wasn't it? Actually mentioning a red herring in the verse. He could have written it up a bit different. Vera cried, "But don't you see? He's mad. It's all mad. The whole thing of going by the rhyme is mad. Dressing up the judge, killing Rogers when he was chopping sticks, drugging Mrs. Rogers so that she overslept herself, arranging for a bumblebee when Miss Brent died. It's like some horrible child playing a game. It's all got to fit in." Bloor said, "Yes, you're right." He thought a minute. "At any rate, there's no zoo on the island. You'll have a bit of trouble getting over that." Vera cried, "Don't you see? We're the zoo. Last night we were hardly human anymore. We're the zoo." They spent the morning on the cliffs, taking it in turns to flash a mirror at the mainland. There were no signs that anyone saw them. No answering signals. The day was fine with a slight haze. Below, the sea heaved in a gigantic swell. There were no boats out. They had made another abortive search of the island. There was no trace of the missing physician. Vera looked up at the house from where they were standing. She said, her breath coming with a slight catch in it, "One feels safer here. Out in the open. Don't let's go back into the house again." Lombard said, "Not a bad idea. We're pretty safe here. No one can get at us without our seeing him a long time beforehand." Vera said, "We'll stay here." Bloor said, "Have to pass the night somewhere. We'll have to go back to the house then." Vera shuddered. "I can't bear it. I can't go through another night." Philip said, "You'll be safe enough, locked in your room." Vera murmured, "I suppose so." She stretched out her hands, murmuring, "It's lovely to feel the sun again." She thought, "How odd. I'm almost happy. And yet I suppose I'm actually in danger, somehow, now. Nothing seems to matter. Not in daylight. I feel full of power. I feel that I can't die." Bloor was looking at his wristwatch. He said, "It's 2 o'clock. What about lunch?" Vera said obstinately, "I'm not going back to the house. I'm going to stay here, in the open." "Oh, come now, Miss Claythorne. Gotta keep your strength up, you know." Vera said, "If I even see a tin tongue, I shall be sick. I don't want any food. People go days on end with nothing sometimes when they're on a diet." Bloor said, "Well, I need my meals regular. What about you, Mr. Lombard?" Philip said, "You know, I don't relish the idea of tin tongue particularly. I'll stay here with Miss Claythorne." Bloor hesitated. Vera said, "I shall be quite all right. I don't think he'll shoot me as soon as your back is turned, if that's what you're afraid of." Bloor said, "It's all right if you say so. But we agreed we ought not to separate." Philip said, "You're the one who wants to go into the lion's den." "I'll come with you if you like." "No, you won't," said Bloor. "You'll stay here." Philip laughed. "So you're still afraid of me? Well, I could shoot you both this very minute if I liked." Bloor said, "Yes, but that wouldn't be according to plan. It's one at a time, and it's got to be done in a certain way." "Well," said Philip, "you seem to know all about it." "Of course," said Bloor. "It's a bit jumpy going up to the house alone." Philip said softly, "And therefore, will I lend you my revolver? Answer, no, I will not. Not quite so simple as that, thank you." Bloor shrugged his shoulders and began to make his way up the steep slope to the house. Lombard said softly, "Feeding time at the zoo. The animals are very regular in their habits." Vera said anxiously, "Isn't it very risky, what he's doing?" "In the sense you mean, no, I don't think it is.
Armstrong's not armed, you know, and anyway, Blore is twice a match for him in physique, and he's very much on his guard. And anyway, it's a sheer impossibility that Armstrong can be in the house. I know he's not there.
But what other solution is there?
Philip said softly. There's Blore.
Oh. Do you really think?
Listen, my girl. You heard Blore's story. You've got to admit that if it's true, I can't possibly have had anything to do with Armstrong's disappearance. His story clears me, but it doesn't clear him. We've only his word for it that he heard footsteps and saw a man going downstairs and out at the front door. The whole thing may be a lie. He may have got rid of Armstrong a couple of hours before that.
How?
Lombard shrugged his shoulders.
That we don't know. But if you ask me, we've only one danger to fear, and that danger is Blore. What do we know about the man? Less than nothing. All this ex-policeman story may be bunkum. He may be anybody, a mad millionaire, a crazy businessman, an escaped inmate of Broadmoor. One thing's certain, he could have done every one of these crimes.
Vera had gone rather white. She said in a slightly breathless voice,
And supposing he gets us?
Lombard said softly, patting the revolver in his pocket. I'm going to take very good care he doesn't. Then he looked at her curiously. Touching faith in me, haven't you, Vera? Quite sure I wouldn't shoot you? Vera said,
One has got to trust someone. As a matter of fact, I think you're wrong about Blore. I still think it's Armstrong.
She turned to him suddenly.
Don't you feel, all the time, that there's someone? Someone watching and waiting.
Lombard said slowly, That's just nerves. Vera said eagerly,
Then you have felt it.
She shivered. She bent a little closer.
Tell me, you don't think...
She broke off, went on.
I read a story once about two judges that came to a small American town from the Supreme Court. They administered justice, absolute justice. Because they didn't come from this world at all.
Lombard raised his eyebrows. He said,
Heavenly visitants, eh? No, I don't believe in the supernatural. This business is human enough.
Vera said in a low voice,
Sometimes. I'm not sure.
Lombard looked at her. He said,
That's conscience.
After a moment's silence, he said very quietly,
So you did drown that kid after all.
Vera said vehemently,
I didn't. I didn't. You've no right to say that.
He laughed easily.
Oh, yes, you did, my good girl. I don't know why. Can't imagine. There was a man in it, probably. Was that it?
A sudden feeling of lassitude, of intense weariness, spread over Vera's limbs. She said in a dull voice,
Yes, there was a man in it.
Lombard said softly,
Thanks. That's what I wanted to know.
Vera sat up suddenly. She exclaimed,
What was that? It wasn't an earthquake.
Lombard said,
No. No, queer, though. A thud shook the ground, and I thought, Did you hear a sort of cry?
I did. They stared up at the house. Lombard said,
It came from there. We'd better go up and see.
No, no, I'm not going.
Please yourself, I am.
Vera said desperately,
All right. I'll come with you.
They walked up the slope to the house. The terrace was peaceful and innocuous-looking in the sunshine. They hesitated there a minute. Then, instead of entering by the front door, they made a cautious circuit of the house. They found Blore. He was spread-eagled on the stone terrace on the east side, his head crushed and mangled by a great block of white marble. Philip looked up. He said,
Whose is that window just above?
Vera said in a low, shuddering voice,
It's mine. And that's the clock from my mantelpiece. I remember now. It was shaped like a bear.
She repeated, and her voice shook and quavered.
It was shaped like a bear.
Philip grasped her shoulder. He said, and his voice was urgent and grim,
This settles it. Armstrong is hiding somewhere in that house. I'm going to get him.
But Vera clung to him. She cried,
Don't be a fool. It's us now. We're next. He wants us to look for him. He's counting on it.
Philip stopped. He said thoughtfully,
There's something in that.
Vera cried,
At any rate, you do admit now I was right.
He nodded.
Yes, you win. It's Armstrong, all right. But where the devil did he hide himself? We went over the place with a fine-tooth comb.
Vera said urgently,
If you didn't find him last night, you won't find him now. That's common sense.